Music, among other things.
Music among other things.
There's probably an email from Ezra to CT and me with a bunch of ideas in like early 2018. early to mid 2017, where there's like a list of all the like ideas he was having at that time. And one of them was the Seinfeld baseline. So like,
yeah,
like I didn't end up doing much with it, but I bought like a book on slap bass technique. I was like, all right, fuck yeah, I'm going to do all this work.
First episode of 2021, and it's episode 21. So it's nice when those numbers align up. You're on with Sean and Neil. Say hello, Neil.
Hello.
So, Neil, you got your care package from George Ford?
I did indeed. Yeah, absolutely made my year already.
Episode 18's guest, of course, George Ford, behind the Fireplace for Your Home series on Netflix. What was it? What was involved in the package? I think we got the same thing.
It was a lovely DVD. It was the Birchwood edition, was it?
I think so,
DVD,
yeah.
And then a signed poster of Fire as well, which I loved. But yeah, great guy.
Yeah.
That's definitely in a time in January when my New Year's resolution is a bit of BMF, be more Ford. Definitely came at a good time. So cheered me up a lot in these tough months. So yeah, that was a really nice surprise. Thanks, George, if you're listening.
Yeah, thanks to George. And I think it was a nice little treat, actually, having that in January, because I think I got it on like the second or third day back at work. And it was just nice having that reminder of his positivity, I guess.
But definitely.
But yeah, I haven't put the DVD on yet, but it's got a loopable feature on it. And I was actually watching it quite a lot over Christmas. It's quite nice having it in the background when I was reading. And I just had a bit of music on in the background. Had that on, but obviously you get to the end of it and then you have to like redo it and stuff. Yeah, so
you just get a random Netflix preview come on for like some random show, FBI show. You're like, no, don't ruin George.
This is not the vibe.
That's a good feature.
Yeah, I think there's a little mountain stream on it, which I think was one of his original ones. So, gonna dive into the history of Ford a bit, which would be nice. We are going to be joined by Chris Bayo today, who most people know as Vampire Weekend's bassist. He was one of the original members, and his third solo album, Dead Hand Control, is out on January the 29th. And yeah, he's coming on to talk about the record with us, obviously, among other things. We're hoping to chat to him about the legacy of him being on the FIFA soundtrack. He also recorded a bit of the album at Damon Albarn Studios, so keen to get into that. And then obviously talking about Vampire Weekend, and Neil, I know you particularly were interested in getting into FIFA with him.
I just can't wait. Yeah, I mean, to have a core member of Vampire Weekend, such a huge band of, I don't know, that golden era into now, of like my favourite music, they're up there with one of my favourite bands. So yeah, definitely looking forward to speaking with Chris. And yeah, when you sent me the song, I instantly thought of FIFA 16 or FIFA 17, whatever it was. So
yeah,
definitely a good FIFA cult song for all those FIFA fans. But yeah, looking forward to it. It should be a good chat.
So before we get into it, there will be links to playlists and things we talk about in the description of the podcast. Give us a like and subscribe, and if you enjoy it, please give us a 5-star rating. It really helps us to get our podcast to the right people. So without further ado, here's our chat with Chris.
Hit it. I have never used Zencastr before. I like the I like how it says health check passed. It feels very appropriate during a global pandemic.
That's right.
We only take people that have tested negative on this podcast.
How's it going? Where are you calling in from at the moment?
I am calling in from the coast of Oregon. I got a house here last year, a small house on the ocean, and it's been very lucky and very nice to be riding out the pandemic here for the past few weeks. I mostly live in Los Angeles. I mean, I know you guys know I lived in London until about 3 years ago, but
yeah,
it's the situation in LA is a bit scary. I mean, I am going back there, I think, at the end of next week, but for right now, I'm in quiet Oregon.
Nice.
So
was that a quiet Christmas time in Oregon as well?
Yeah, it was, and it was really nice actually, because it was the first time in 3 years that I had a Christmas tree, and I'm not religious. I'm not a big holiday person, but it's been explained to me that the Christmas tree is a pagan tradition that's been passed along, and I just my childish love of Christmas trees has not left, even though I'm 36 years old. And the last time I had a Christmas tree was when I still lived in London. I lived in Peckham.
Oh, right.
And I would have I had an annual Christmas party called Pexmas, where we would sing Christmas carols. And we would go to there's a Pexmas market that's unaffiliated with my Pexmas party, but we would go to the market, the Christmas market, and then, drink some Christmas drinks. So at the very least, having a Christmas tree this year for the first time in 3 years has been really nice. That's been probably the highlight of my holidays.
Oh, amazing.
Nice.
Sort of curious how a New Yorker got on over in the streets of London. Did you enjoy it over here?
Yeah, I really loved it. And it's probably my favorite place I've ever lived. And in a way, I guess I should probably look up the stat again, but when I moved from New York to London, I think that the population of New York was about 10,000 more people. So it was like 8 million, blah, 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 blah. Almost the identical population between the two cities, which kind of blew my mind, because for all the cultural differences between America and the UK, I find that New York and London have so much in common. And in a way, London feels the most like New York of any place on the planet. I found living in Los Angeles to be way, way, way more different than living in either New York or London. So I took really naturally to it. I loved my 5 years there. I was in Islington for the first 2 years and Peckham for the last three. Made some like really, really great friends. Obviously, like, made my first two solo records there exclusively. And yeah, it was a time in my life that I feel lucky to have had. You know, I would have been, I guess, 29. Yeah, I was 29 when I moved there. So, you know, when you get to a certain age, you don't necessarily expect having the opportunity to move to another country. So, I love it and I miss it. And it, like, the fact that we are in the midst of a global pandemic and it's not safe to get on a plane, whenever I watch TV and see anything in Europe, I feel like I'm going to start crying because I miss it so much. It's, was a very special time for me. And it's, you know, it's a time that I definitely associate with, starting to make solo albums and starting to sing on records and starting to learn how to do that. And it's just I hopefully I've communicated that I fucking love London. That's essentially the main message.
It's funny. I sent when you were coming on the podcast, I sent Neil some of the new tracks, but I also sent him Sister of Pearl from a few years ago. And I'm not a gamer as such, but Neil instantly recognized it from FIFA 16 soundtrack.
Mm.
And you said a few of your mates did as well, right, Neil?
Yeah, like, it's just a huge FIFA song. I mean, it sounds really stupid, but I remember when I wanted to, you know, to be like a musician when I was younger and stuff, I always thought playing like FIFA 11 and FIFA 12 and stuff, that the day you make it will be the day you get on FIFA soundtrack. Over here, it's like, I don't know if you know about that kind of, I don't know, history of FIFA soundtracks, but it's like they are like really great soundtracks. They're actually like four games. They're just known to be great soundtracks that you generally would put on Spotify as like a FIFA playlist. You go on Spotify and search FIFA, there's so many FIFA playlists because they're just renowned for having great soundtracks. And as soon as Sean sent me that song, I just immediately thought FIFA, and I've sent it to a couple of mates, you know, today, yesterday, and being like, yeah, I'm into, you know, we're talking to this guy, did this amazing FIFA tune. just so, yeah, I guess it was just, yeah, pretty mind-blowing, but it's quite random as well, so I just wanted to know kind of how that came about, really.
Yeah, of course. I love that question. And to answer it, I had no idea about this incredible culture around FIFA soundtracks at the time, and now I am very, very aware of it. So I would have found out, and I guess, you know, probably 2 years before, I think there's a Vampire Weekend song, maybe it's Worship You on one of the FIFA soundtracks. Yeah. I would not have like clocked how influential it was. And then basically, I don't know, you know, 2 months after Sister of Pearl came out as a song, the label was like, great news. This is really, really great. It's going to be on FIFA. And I was like, okay, that's fun. I used to love playing video games. I played NHL 94 a lot when I was growing up, but I didn't understand how big of a deal it was. And then once it came out, it's just, yeah, I mean, all the YouTube comments are about FIFA. You know, when I did my first, like, European tour, I'd play like in Zurich, Switzerland. I played a really fun show. It was maybe for like 50 people, but like a kind of nerdy guy came up to me afterwards who like didn't strike me as like a huge live music guy. And he's like, listen, it's so incredible to meet you. I absolutely love FIFA. This means so much to me that I'm meeting you. And that's awesome. I really loved it. And then, the gentleman who, plays guitar with me, and he plays guitar on the last two records, like live, this guy George Hume, he's from Great Yarmouth in England, he lives in London now. He told me, I felt a little bit bad for him, but you know, we would go on these tours and it would be just the two of us. We'd be like a month in a van driving around US. I mean, it was incredible. Like, he's the brother I never had, like, had so much fun traveling with him. But he would be home from tour and like would be playing, you know, he's a big football fan. He would play FIFA with his friends. And then like at halftime, Sister of Pearl would come on the soundtrack, and it would just take him completely out of the game because it just reminded him of the tour he either had just come home from or was about to go on. So
that's brilliant.
But yeah, it's, no, I totally, the power of it, I really, really appreciate it. And the song has had like a nice sort of second life in the past 6 months because it was on the show Umbrella Academy, that's pretty popular on Netflix. So,
Jared Way's show, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it's now, you know, I can't pretend that I'm not above occasionally looking at the Sister of Pearl YouTube comments, but there's a good debate coming over whether it's cooler to discover the song on FIFA or Umbrella Academy. So I like that. And also I did end up a couple years ago, I got a remix that I did for this Spanish artist, Gizmo Varias, also ended up on FIFA. I think FIFA 19, if that's possible. FIFA 19.
Yeah.
So and that, you know, that song had, you know, very few people had heard it before that. And now a lot of people have heard it on, you know, streaming service and stuff exclusively because of FIFA. So, always like an exciting honor that they did it. And I didn't realize it the first time it happened, but the second time I was like, oh fuck yeah, this is incredible, because I realized how like powerful it was.
Yeah, like no joke. Like I've had FIFA since I was about 8 years old, since like the old consoles and stuff. But literally the first thing I do every time I get a new FIFA is go straight to the EA tracks and look at the soundtrack. Like genuinely, I don't play a match. I don't look at the football teams. The first thing I do is check out the EA tracks. And there's always been some just, you know, some artists you never, like, you haven't heard as much music about, but then some artists you're like, oh my God, I haven't heard them in ages. But it's always been like a great soundtrack and like a really kind of fun, positive sound as well. But
yeah, I actually have a question for you, Neil, in the, like, because the most recent FIFA would have come out in September. Is it weird? Is it weird to play it and have like a huge audience in the stadium in the middle of a pandemic? Is it like a surreal thing?
That's true, actually. Yeah, there should be like a COVID mode.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, I guess it is weird. Yeah, just watch like celebrations and stuff. Like just celebrating to no one. It's weird because over here when we watch like football, they've got two versions you can watch. They've got one with crowd, like fake crowd, and then one without. So there's literally some guy's job right now. So it's creating jobs in some ways, I guess. There's some guy's job right now who, when they're watching a football match, they're in control of Sky Sports sound. So you'll get someone hitting it just over the bar and nearly scoring. And this guy's on like a 5 second delay, and it like, I don't know, 5 seconds later, you just hear this. it's pretty funny, but yeah, it's quite weird when you play without, when you hear without sound, it just sounds like a training game. You can hear all the players fucking like swearing at each other.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, they wouldn't let us do that in America with American sports. There's way too much cursing.
Yeah.
We do a thing called recently added on the show, so it's just basically like a candid telling of anything that's been recently added to your Spotify, Apple Music, or whatever it might be. Have you got anything you've been listening to a lot recently?
Yeah, I there's a couple things that I like recently added that I really loved. One, I don't know. I think I would have just been like going down a kind of like krautrock and krautrock adjacent wormhole, but this German group called Dunkelziffer, Dunkelziffer.
Cool.
They put out a record in, I think it's the early 80s, called Colors and Soul. And, you know, like when I did college radio, I listened to so much krautrock. I have a project with my friend Mike Green, who's Fort Rameau, that's very krautrock influenced. And I still like end up finding all these like weird kraut and then post kraut records. There just is an endless, and I guess this would probably be like more post kraut rock ish because it's the 80s, and like there's like a heavy like dub influence in it. The drums and bass are so cool, but it's just a record that I had like, I should have heard of this record like 15 years ago when I did college radio, and I just didn't. And like kind of discovering a record that you haven't heard of that's old that you love, I end up feeling two emotions when I do that, because at the one hand it's like, oh hell yeah, there's this record that's incredible. Yeah. I absolutely love this music. But on the other hand, it like fills me with maybe like a little bit of melancholy knowing that there's so much music out there, so many records that I absolutely would love if I had heard that I will not find over the course of my lifetime. You know, like the idea that it's taken me 36 years to find this awesome record, it gives me a little bit of melancholy.
That's very true. Yeah, I mean, there is the hope that there is the next best thing waiting for you at your fingertips next time you're browsing on Apple Music or whatever it might be. But yeah, I completely get what you mean though. That sounds cool. I need to do some more digging into krautrock. It's a genre I haven't explored too much, but I know there's like a lot of influence on the Bowie Berlin period and things of that nature, and I know you're particularly inspired by Bowie and Roxy Music in your solo stuff anyway, and you've got I feel like you've got a really great voice for that sort of thing as well. I mean, you've got this really nice sort of croon. I mean, how did that develop? Has that always been there since you've been maybe writing in the background, or did that come more to the forefront when you were writing your solo albums?
It was something I thought about a lot, particularly on this record, Dead Hand Control. Yeah. So when I would play live and sing in front of a stage in a loud crowd, like I had a couple recordings, and my voice was always better like live than it was on record. And that's usually not the case for a lot of singers. And I really just thought about it, and I kind of realized that like, when you're in a loud club and there's bass everywhere and there's all these loud sounds, it just, the music feels so much more physical. I mean, that's obviously the appeal of going to a nightclub versus listening to music on your headphones. That's the appeal of going to a show versus listening to a record at like a low volume, right? It becomes more physical when it hits a certain volume. But I just realized that like, when it becomes more physical, I sing more from the chest. And there's something that can be a bit clinical about like recording vocals in a studio where you have headphones on, music is coming into your ears, but you don't necessarily feel it in your chest. So my natural inclination, I kind of realized, was like, oh, fuck, okay, I'm singing a bit more, like, more out of my nose, more nasally, because I'm not feeling the music in the same way. Mm. And I'm also, like, a big fan of Peter Gabriel. And I don't... Do you guys ever watch those classic album documentaries?
Yeah, I think I watched the Fleetwood Mac one the other day, actually.
They're all so good, but the one that I come back to the most is the one for So, which Daniel Lanois produced. And I always found it kind of fascinating that, like, Peter Gabriel hated wearing headphones, and I'm sure he still hates wearing headphones while he records vocals. So he had a very, you know, this was in the 80s, they had a very, very special setup where he would have a little speaker playing the music and he would just sing into the mic. And that's kind of like how he would get his vocal sound. And it was very, very, you had to like really position everything right so that the bleed wouldn't come down the mic the wrong way. But he just kind of realized what it took to get the best take. Now, the way that I told that story would make it think that I did the exact same thing, but I didn't. I just, I realized as I get to the bottom, I just became super, super cognizant, when I was recording vocals for this record, and I know you wanted to get into it, but I was lucky enough to record vocals at Damon Albarn's 13 Studios in West London. But when I was recording them, I was just like cognizant the entire time. Hold your nose, sing from your chest, sing as low as you can sing. Just like you have it in you, and it's just a matter of getting it out of you. And I was super, super cognizant of that with this record, to like just explore the like baritone and low points of my voice as much as I could, because I do find that's my favorite part of my voice, at least. And I appreciate you asking this question. I've gotten a couple friends who I've sent the record to said that, yeah, my voice sounds like a lot better this time. And, my mother-in-law texted me that my voice sounded a lot deeper on the two songs that came out when they came out. So I appreciated that. So it's just it was a process, but it was something that I really thought about and did a lot of work toward to like achieve on this record, I guess I'd say.
Yeah, it sounds amazing for it. I mean, there's so many great moments on this record, you know, a lot of shifts in structure that, you know, sound strange, but in the best way, and it all fits together. It's, you know, a really great piece of work, and particularly on that first track. And I think even throughout all of that, it's ultimately stacked with earworms and just sounds incredible for it as well. I mean, tell us a bit about how the album came together. Has it something that's been simmering over a few years? Because a lot of it seems relevant now, particularly in reference to like the apocalypse and the end of something and the anxiety and things like that. Particularly thinking recently, like that lyric, when you're feeling like the world of noise is going to drown you in your sleep.
Yeah, it's well, I finished the record, I think, next week is going to be a year ago. So I finished all the lyrics, all the recording, everything short of mixing it in the middle of last January. So pre-hearing of COVID, pre-all that stuff. I would have first kind of like thought about the ideas of this record kind of right when the last record had like come out and had kind of lived its early life. So maybe like a month after my record Man of the World came out, I had read about this concept, Dead Hand Control. Yeah. And it was in the context of this writer, Edward Albee, who died, and in his will, he made all these demands of how his work would be represented, and some that I find kind of despicable, like the racial casting of people in plays based on the plays he's written,
right,
and things that I find more interesting. Like one provision in his will was that any unfinished work of his be destroyed. And
right,
that idea of like dictating in your will what's going to happen to your stuff and what the people you give your stuff to do with your stuff is called dead hand control. Another kind of like famous example of this would be when MCA of Beastie Boys died. He said, I don't want any Beastie Boys song ever to be in a commercial. That was in his will.
Yeah.
And that kind of stuff is very, to my limited reading, is a murky territory of the law. It's like, at least in America, it's kind of unclear how enforceable that stuff is. And it got me thinking a lot about what you as a person or as an artist can control. At the same time, I'm a student of Russian history. I majored in college in Russian regional studies. I find the history of Russia fascinating, particularly the Soviet era. And I had known already that there was this rumored nuclear system called Dead Hand or Perimeter that was developed. It was never like confirmed its true existence, but it's believed to still exist. And what Dead Hand or Perimeter would do in the, you know, 80s, I believe, is when it started, maybe late 70s, is if it detected a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union, it would automatically nuke America. So it was a computer that...
Insane.
That essentially, if it detected an attack, it would destroy our, you know, the country that I live in again. I tend to start most songs, honestly, with the title. And a title will come to me and I'll just think, oh, that could be a song, but what does that song sound like? I find that to be the most like interesting and exciting way to start music. And similarly, with records, it's the exact same thing. So I had read about this thing called Dead Hand Control, and I was like, I just knew right away that there was a lot there and that I wanted to make a record with that title. So that would have been, I don't know, July of 2017. And then for probably a year, obviously I was doing other things, but I would just collect little ideas where it would mostly be like song titles, some chord progressions, little hooks, but not really actively working on it. And then in 2018, really, is when I started. I moved to LA, started building out a studio, and started recording it in earnest. So I would have started it in summer 2018. I would have recorded the vocals mostly at Damon's studio in like May of 2019, finished it in 2021, but like, or 20, sorry, January 2020. But like, I can't pretend that like reading these things, it occurred in a bubble and had nothing to do with what was going on and what's been going on. I as we're sitting here recording this, it's January 7th, and there was kind of a pathetic quasi coup attempt here in the United States yesterday, which is fucking crazy to say.
Insane.
But I tend to get fairly, if I don't have much going on, fairly glued to the television when events like that happen. And last night, multiple people were making the point on television that the current president of the United States has been frozen out of Twitter, has been frozen out of Facebook, and still has control of the U.S. nuclear codes. And I can't pretend that the fact that for now, close to 4 years, an unhinged maniac has had control of the largest nuclear arsenal on the planet has nothing to do with me making a record about these concepts and ideas. It's obviously a huge part. And my last record, I felt, was like almost too direct in terms of like attempting to address the times. And so I felt that thinking about nuclear fallout, thinking about what an artist can control, is kind of like a jumping off point in a way that is obviously related to the times. And obviously, like, I was thinking about what would you do in like an extreme event. And obviously now we've been living through a pretty extreme event for about 10 months and the idea of being good to the people in your life. It just, it's all connected, obviously, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to say, because, I mean, despite the, you know, obviously all the mention of nuclear holocaust and things of that nature, it's actually a very optimistic record at the end of the day, I think, which I really enjoyed. And it's great that you were able to pull that positivity out of it at the end of it. Which I think is a really great achievement there.
Thank you.
I've been watching your videos as well for this album, Chris, and really like the Endless Me, Endless Lee video. I saw on the little Q&A you did on Twitter, you were talking about reversing the audio and then transcribing it backwards and everything. Was that quite a long process to do, or was it, you know, did you manage to get your head around it quite quickly?
No, it took me, it's like extremely boring was the one thing. And so listening to the songs backwards is like very beautiful. I don't know. It just obviously you don't usually listen to like purely backwards music, but it's like there's still melody and the like tones are different and the rhythm is different. I found it pretty fascinating, actually.
It is cool. I remember actually when I was probably 15 or something, I reversed an Arctic Monkeys song and then showed it to my sister and said, oh, have you heard about this new Norwegian band? And stuck it on. And then she totally bought it. She was like, oh, that sounds pretty cool, actually. And it was like one of the tracks like from Favorite Worst Nightmare backwards. But yeah, I think there is something with listening to something. But I mean, are you in a position where you can, could you perform Endless Me, Endless Lee backwards live?
I could if I had a teleprompter. Yeah, we filmed the video now like we filmed it 2 months ago now, so it's not, yeah. I remember little bits of it, fresh. But I you know what, I definitely could if need be. And actually I saw They Might Be Giants one time performed one of their songs backwards, and it's pretty sick.
Wow.
Jesus.
Good. There must be a real like head scratcher getting that right. I've got
also got to ask about.
You mentioned that you recorded some of the album at Damon Albarn's studio. Yeah, I've got to ask what it's like in there, 'cause I've always wanted to go there. I've always read about it, and I think he did a show with Jules Holland a few years ago where he was sort of showing these ancient bells that he has, which rings out with all these different notes. I mean, what was it like in that place and recording there?
Yeah, it was incredible. The guy that I work with on all my solo music is a guy named John Foyle. He used to work at XL, and he like engineered and did vocal production on my first record, The Names, and did the same thing on this record, Dead Hand Control. And he co-produced my second record, Man of the World. But you know, he's the person who was in the trenches with me, like trying to make that first record. Like, you know, we were trying to figure out together how my vocals could work on a record. And he's just like a great dear friend. But so he had left his job at XL either late 2018 or early 2019. And I, for some reason, like in the back of my head, he definitely told me he was moving to a room at 13 Studios. So it's, I guess it's like outside Westbourne Park. It's in a pretty industrial part of West London, but like I wasn't thinking about it. And I got there at the outside of the studio. I was like, oh fuck, we're going to be in the building of 13 Studios. And I don't think I even really registered that this was a possibility, but John, you know, opened the door. He said, how's it going? Big hug. Hadn't seen each other in maybe a year or something. And he was like, oh, so, because Damon is on tour right now with The Good, the Bad, and the Queen, we can use his room today and tomorrow. Amazing. So it was like a 2-day session. And have you guys ever read the Alex James book, Bit of a Blur?
I haven't, no.
It's interesting. I enjoyed it. I mean, I read it like 12 years ago. But the, like, one thing that he describes, the one word he's described Damon, is generous in that book. And I have since met him a couple times, Damon, and I think that that's a great description of him. But first and foremost, the fact that he would let other artists use his studio essentially for free when he's gone is, I just want to say, like, unbelievably generous. Like, so many people in his same position would not allow that. I mean, it, because he was on tour, I got to go in there and, you know, didn't have to pay any extra or anything like that. Got to use all his toys. So,
wow, that's amazing.
For me, he is, you know, one of the top five songwriters on the planet that's still alive right now. I don't know. It's, was a huge, huge Blur fan growing up. I, you know, love Gorillaz. I love, the kind of like fun he has with projects that he'll do a Chinese opera one year and then make a kind of quasi like post-punk album. And it can be like, he'll play, I mean, around that time, he was playing, doing a tour of, like, working men's clubs in Wales, right? I don't know if you guys remember that, like, with The Good, The Bad, and The Queen. Like, just doing, like, weird, fun shit with music like that. Like, I really, really admire it.
It's great, yeah.
So it's, you know, it's in the basement of this recording complex. It has all the toys that I could ever, ever want. It's just very, very, I don't know. We got in there and I did vocals for 6 of the 8 songs in the 2 days. You know, there was obviously re-singing parts later on, but it was doing that. I did all the piano on Damon's piano. I feel okay revealing this, but there's a little sticker on his piano that says "I Heart Melancholy," which, like, you know, he's the king. He's the king of melancholy music. Yeah. So, like, I don't know. Seeing that piano that so much music I love has been written on was so fucking fun. He, you know, I put a lot of synths on the record, synths that I don't have at my studio in Los Angeles. You know, that they've been in that complex since 2007. So I'm fairly certain the, like, and also one thing that's fun of going in someone's studio is that, like, the last time Damon touched that gear, he would have left the settings on, right? Like, so, like, whatever synth sounds were plugged in, you think about it, it's like, that's what Damon probably had, or whoever else came in for a session. One of the synths on Cast Noir on the chorus, I'm almost positive it's like the synth that's on Melancholy Hill, that gorilla song that I love.
Oh, really?
Like, that's so cool.
Like, I just, you know, it was one that John suggested, and then it's like this big synth pad, and it's, you know, it's there's a lot going on Cast Noir that you wouldn't make that connection, but it's like I got to put Damon synth on my record. I said this at the time talking to friends, like, afterwards, it was my happiest 2 days in a recording studio ever in my life. I've never gotten so much work done. It was, you know, I would have been a little bit, like, tired because of, like, you know, the band had played Radio 1 Big Weekend. We drove down, I slept, I would have gone for a run in the morning. So I would have started at, like, I don't know, noon that day in the studio. And I finished, John and I probably finished around 2 a.m. I was staying with friends in West London. So I walked home and got to their place at like 2:30 and set off their burglar alarm getting back into the house. I felt very, very, like, guilty about that. But it just, that was the first day. And then the second day, we probably did another 10 hours. And I've never, like, had a more productive time and never a more productive 2 days in the studio in my life.
Oh, incredible. Incredible. Oh, yeah. Awesome. I wish I could spend some time there. It'd be awesome. I was also listening back to your podcast as well, Chris, the Road Taken, which is really awesome part about being on the road. And I think, you know, being on the road probably gets romanticized a lot by people like me and Neil thinking about going out and playing every night. And obviously there must be some real highs in that lifestyle, but also some, like, you know, the admin-y side of things, or, you know, just cracking on. And that's a really good insight into it. And I was thinking about your recent leg with Vampire Weekend, because that's been a completely different thing for you guys, where especially compared to your first three albums. I mean, you were digging into that jam band feel, and you had pretty much all your songs, you know, ready to drop, you know, at the drop of a hat. I think you had them all prepared or something, because we actually had Brian Robert Jones on episodes back, which was really fun talking to him. But we came down to, well, me and my girlfriend came down to the morning show in London, and I caught you guys at Glastonbury as well, which is awesome. But it'd be cool to know, you know, what that leg of Vampire Weekend was like, because it seemed like you guys were having a lot of fun with it, and obviously it's quite different. I mean, how does that compare to the old days?
Oh, it was a different band. I mean, that's the thing. We just, I was thinking about this. I may have even said this at like an episode of The Road Taken, but from the point of the like first, Vampire Weekend practice and the first real Vampire Weekend tour was something like 15 months. So we would have formed as a band in like February of 2006, and then our first tour was summer of 2007 before the first record came out. And with this new iteration, it was almost the exact same amount of time. You know, we did little shows here and there, but we would have started rehearsing for the Father of the Bride tour when I came to Los Angeles, when I moved in February of 2018. And then the first real tour was May of 2019, June of 2019. So we had 15 months of playing together and rehearsing and kind of figuring out what this new iteration of the band was going to be, and jamming, which is a world that I'm not familiar with. I mean, CT was in jam bands his whole life. I played, you know, pop punk, and I DJed, and that was very much not my world. And kind of learning about improvisations and solos. And I mean, we got to a place where we were, I think we would have had in our, like, under our fingers around 80 songs, maybe a little over 80 between like B-sides, covers, and then the whole catalog. And
incredible.
Every single show, we did our best to have like a different set list. And it's something that it was definitely challenging for all of us to learn that much music and like be able to get on stage and do something very different. Because if you know, Setlist FM is a fun website. If you look at Vampire Weekend tours from 2010, 2013, it's the same set list every night, you know, like for each tour. And for me, that would like burn me out. If you would finish a tour, it was like, okay, we're getting on stage and it's going to be all the same notes at all the same time, and just the repetition would get like super boring.
It's called draining.
The show, I mean, like, getting in front of a crowd is always exciting, but if you're playing all the same songs in the same order every single night, there's just going to be the repetition of touring is going to be like exacerbated by doing that. So the challenge of playing something different every night, you know, while being more taxing, is ultimately so much more fun. When I think in my mind about the band moving forward, like having a fifth album, having however many songs to add to the repertoire, doing it, having seven albums out and doing it 10 years from now, and how many songs are in the repertoire and like how different it can get every night. It like gets me so excited about playing music for the rest of my life, to be frank. And it's something that I wasn't expecting when, you know, we would be having these conversations about moving the band in more of a jam direction. So, it was, just a wonderful experience. And, you know, I feel on the one hand, so lucky that we got a year of touring in when, you know, we're coming up on a year when nobody can tour. We got to do a year. Can you imagine? I feel so bad for any artist that worked hard on their record and then put the record out and then couldn't play a single live show. That's many, many friends of mine are in that position. At the same time, I feel like there's this sense of unfinished business. We were supposed to be on tour through last fall. You know, we had another 40 or 50 shows to play on Father of the Bride. So whenever it's safe and whenever we can get back out there and continue it, I'm like so excited for it.
Yeah, it must be such a refreshing format. I think Brian Robert Jones was saying the same thing, as in he was used to opening up for different people on like a, they might have a 30-minute set, and he just said that would get super boring so quickly, but he seemed to love being with you guys out on tour.
Oh yeah, it was amazing. And also like getting to play with the four new people, get Brian, Will, yeah, Garrett and Greta, they're all fucking incredible musicians. I've never in my life played with a guitarist that is like has the abilities of Brian. I've never played with a keyboard player. I mean, all of them. Like, I've never played with people who are so like inventive and technical. And it was honestly the like best collection of musicians I've ever played with in my life. I've been playing music since I was 9 years old. So getting to do that when you're in your mid 30s is incredible.
I think it's quite refreshing for people like me and Sean to hear, because you think band like Vampire Weekend, you're like experts at their craft, but it's quite refreshing to hear, no matter where you are in your career, there's always more like to learn and to thrive from and to look forward to as well, which is great to hear as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's how everyone should be, I think. I think that musicians shouldn't be complacent. I think that,
You mentioned covers, and definitely got a shout out the Seinfeld bass line you laid down. I can't remember where that was in the session. You might remember.
That was in, yeah. I mean, God, there's probably an email. God, there's probably an email from Ezra to CT and me with a bunch of ideas in like early 2018. early to mid 2017, where there's like a list of all the like ideas he was having at that time, and one of them was the Seinfeld bass line. So like,
yeah,
like I didn't end up doing much with it, but I bought like a book on slap bass technique. I was like, all right, fuck yeah, I'm gonna do all this work. And then I just started like practicing the like Seinfeld bass line. And also like I'm married, I was still living in Peckham at that time. And like my wife's a writer, so she was at home writing. And like my wife writes like Regency romance novels. So she would be in her office down the hall in our like little place in Peckham. And I would be in my little room. That was my music studio in Peckham, practicing the Seinfeld slap bass line, which is like just such an absurd thing to put on anybody. There's like, we lived next door to this like small Catholic church in Peckham that was like, I could hear the like church services on Sundays, which I always loved. But like, I just imagine people being in church, hearing me practice the Seinfeld bass line, just like all the like stupid shit. But so when our like big like coming back, we're playing live in America. We had done a couple shows in Ojai in June of 2018. So this is already almost a year before Father of the Bride came out. But we did we did a couple festivals. We played in Australia, Japan, and then we headlined our stage at Lollapalooza. And that was our big, like, first U.S. show coming back with this new, operation. And I tend to not get nervous before I get on stage. I tend to, like, I practice a lot. I kind of know how it's gonna go. I definitely, yeah, like the first time I sang for like when my first record came out, I was definitely nervous. By like the third show, I wasn't nervous anymore. And like before this show, I was so nervous, and I was so nervous about one thing and one thing only, and it was that I knew that during New Dorp I was gonna do the Seinfeld theme song on a massive festival stage in front of a bunch of people on bass. and when we were playing New Dorp, like, you know, there are all these cues and stuff, and we got to the end of like the kind of solo section, and Ezra was kind of getting ready to like sing again. I think he kind of forgot for a second about the Seinfeld part because it was on the set list. So I was like, all right, fuck, okay, maybe I got away, maybe I don't need to play the Seinfeld theme song, maybe I'll be all right. But then he remembered, and so having that little like nudge before I got into it, I was like, all right, fuck it. And then I played the Seinfeld theme song to much glory. But it was definitely like the most nervous I've been on stage in a long time. Now occasionally, wow, I should like, God, there There was like, I'm a big fan. Do you guys listen to Stars of the Lid or like ambient music or new classical music?
Not really. Like, well informed in that.
There's a band, Stars of the Lid, that I love, and one of the members of it has a band called The Winged Victory for the Solon that just makes beautiful, beautiful ambient music. And yeah. I'm a huge fan of his, and he lives in Brussels, and like I kind of last minute, we were getting dinner with a friend in Brussels, and he's like, oh my god, this guy's one of my best friends, let me invite him to the show. So like this guy who makes beautiful ambient music that I love came to the show in Brussels. And during the request section of the Vampire Weekend show, somebody requested the Seinfeld theme song. So getting to play that in front of a musician that I'm a huge fan of was pretty funny at the end of 2019. And like, I don't know, I just realized now, and I was a little sloppy because I hadn't been practicing it, but because of the nature of the Vampire Weekend live experience, I realized that essentially I should always practice the Seinfeld theme song at least once a week on bass, so it's always under my fingers.
I love that as a method. It's quite funny to think that your wife is sitting in the other room trying to get into the zone of writing this Renaissance romance novel, and she hears
that image cracks me up, to be fair. You must be so close to, like, every time you make a joke, just ending on that, like, that's brilliant.
Thanks so much for your time, Chris. Sorry, I know we've gone a little bit over. There's one more question I wanted to ask you about. The film Burnt.
Yeah.
Which is, I think you listed out your film in 2020. You just listed out Burnt 20 times in a row. And it's funny because it was a post. I've never seen the film, but the poster struck me when they were doing the promotion on the Underground. Because it's just Bradley Cooper with his arms crossed. On like quite a plain background, and like the word art sort of font of Burnt, and I was like, I don't know, there's something intriguing about it. And I actually watched a trailer last night, but what is it about that film that has you so enthralled with it, and do you recommend us watching?
Yes, I absolutely recommend you watching it. I appreciate it. This is, you know, I've been posting shit about Burnt for years now, and this is the first time anyone's ever asked me about Burns in an interview. I mean, the story of my love of Burnt is kind of insane. That movie had a massive marketing budget behind it. So, right, like, I remember I was living in London at the time. Everywhere on the Underground, you just see Bradley Cooper dressed as a chef with his arms crossed and the word Burnt over it. And just, like, thinking in my head, what the fuck is this movie? This looks like a TV show from, like, 15 years ago. Like, who cares about, like, a bad boy chef? It's, like, the most expired archetype on the planet. And there's a bit of a sad element to the story, which is that we would have had some friends over for dinner, like this one night in, I guess, November of, what year was that? That was like 2015. And, you know, one of our friends who was with us had been, he had lived in France. But anyways, we were just having a dinner party. Someone checked their phone and like, the Eagles of Death Metal, like the attack on the Bataclan club had happened. And, you know, my friend had lived in France. He lived in Paris. He was like super paranoid that he had friends at the show. He started crying. It was all so heavy. I was like in such a bad mood. I mean, this is like my industry. I'm a touring musician. I go to venues all the time. This is like... people I know, had people who were in that crew. Look, nobody I knew got hurt, but the idea of anybody like going to a concert and seeing music and dying, it was like breaks my heart.
Yeah.
So the next day, my wife and I were sitting at home in absolutely toxic moods, just feeling so, so depressed. And we were like, fuck, we need to get out of our heads. What are we going to do? And I lived in Peckham, like down the road from a movie theater called Peckhamplex, and all the movies would be first run new movies, and it would be like £4.99 to go. And we were like, fuck, okay, we should just go to the movies. And then we like looked up, and the only thing that was playing that we could see was Burnt. And we like sat in the theater, and like, it just is such a crazy movie and like such a mess and so like fascinating. And like, it got us out of our heads for 2 hours. So whatever. And there's like a part in the movie that I won't spoil for you that's just so insane that we were like laughing in the theater. Anyways, like, I don't know, maybe a month later, I'm like, I have an email list with a couple friends, and a friend, like, we like joke about movies, but a friend's like, oh, I just watched Burnt on a plane. I found it fascinating. And then like, we started talking about Burnt, and we like couldn't stop talking about Burnt. We talked about Burnt for like 100 emails over like this 100 email thread with all our thoughts on Burnt. And then like, we just would go to parties. I'd go to parties in London, and also because Burnt takes place in London, it makes it like especially hilarious. We would just like talk for a very alienating attitude, just like be at a house party talking about Burnt for like an hour with other people around who like haven't seen Burnt. But so, yeah. I don't know, we just kept talking about Burnt and we couldn't stop. So we started like having these insane little parties. Like we had a Burnt Sunday where the movie takes place largely at the Langham in central London. So we would get a cocktail at the Langham in central London. And then there's this insane product placement for the Burger King at Leicester Square. So we walked to Leicester Square and ate at the Burger King. And then we went to my house and watched Burnt. And then now I have like a WhatsApp group with about like 7 other people called Preeminent Burnt Scholars. And like every couple of days we just like keep talking about Burnt. And then we like every couple weeks or every couple months, we like sync up a Burnt screening during the pandemic. So we have people on the West Coast. We have people in New York. We have people in London, and we have one in Sydney, Australia. So there's like limited time, but we like sync it all up and all watch Burnt at the same time and talk about Burnt on the WhatsApp group. So it has been like a shockingly big part of my life for the last half decade.
That is amazing.
I know exactly what I'm going to do as soon as the COVID restrictions are lifted. Going to do that Burnt pilgrimage
from Langham. Sure, that's what we'll watch with the girls.
We'll do that. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Chris, and see you next time.